Everybody. Good afternoon. Thank you for attending this session. I'm very delighted to chair it. It's actually, as I understand, the third in an ongoing series of sessions called Centering Recovering Lesbian Histories and Memories. My name is Daniel Baranowski. I'm working for the Federal Foundation Magnus Hirschfeld, which is the Bundesstiftung Magnus Hirschfeld here in Berlin, and at the foundation, I'm in charge of everything related to LGBTIQ culture, history, and memory. And just to very quickly outline the structure of this session, we have four presentations by five speakers. Each presentation is scheduled for 15 minutes, and we will have time, approximately 30 minutes, for questions and discussions after the four presentations. Our first presentation in this session comes from Lourdes Torres, who is a professor of Latin American and Latino Studies at DePaul University in Chicago and editor of the journal Latino Studies. Her research and teaching interests include sociolinguistics and queer Latinidades, and she is the author of Puerto Rican Discourse, a Sociolinguistic Study of a New York Suburb, and co-editor of Third World Women and the Politics of Feminism and Tortilleras, Hispanic and the Latina Lesbian Expression. Her recent articles appear in GLQ, Journal of Lesbian and Gay Studies, the Journal of Lesbian Studies, and Meridians, and she's currently working on a project on the history of Latina lesbian organizing in Chicago, and another on coalition building among LGBTIQ multicultural communities. And her presentation is called Multicultural Lesbian Coalition Building in Chicago, 1990s to 2000s. How do we tell these stories? The floor is yours. Thank you. Can somebody please help? I'm not supposed to do this.
Yeah.
No, there it is. Okay.
Okay, and then I hit this one. Okay, hello everyone. Thank you for your help, and I'm really happy to see all of you here. My paper is motivated by an interest in thinking about the best ways to create solidarity across queer communities today. Coalitions or temporary alliances are an important mechanism for dispossessed people and organizations with similar goals to combine resources, increase their power, and amplify their voices in the service of a common objective. My work explores efforts to build coalitions across lesbians of color in Chicago, from the 1980s, 90s to the 2000s. Since the scholarship that exists on queer organizing in the Midwest mostly fails to engage with the history of people of color organizing, this project focuses on queer people of color as agents for change. Given that Chicago is one of the most racially segregated cities in the United States, political collaborations among diverse organizations of any type is noteworthy. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender organizations of color have a rich history of forging such connections in Chicago, which has yet to be documented. For today's talk, I will focus on one of these coalitional projects, as well as the the political, social, and cultural events and programs that emerged from this effort at working together across lesbian identity groups. I explore the extent to which these movements of coming together yielded sustained partnerships to combat problems faced by lesbians of color, and the degree to which the partnerships challenged and engaged with the white mainstream LGBTQ movement. I am interested in thinking about the best way or what some of the best models for organizing across complex national, racial, ethnic, and linguistic politics might be, since these continue to be relevant, obviously, today for queer organizations committed to social change. Therefore, as I document this history, I'm really interested in the best ways of sharing this information with young activists through digital formats and other methods, which is one of the reasons I'm at this conference to learn. My methods include oral history and archival research. This project is an extension of my research on Latina lesbian organizing. I've written about the establishment and life of two Latina lesbian organizations in Chicago, YENA, which ran from the late 80s to the early 1990s, and Amigas Latinas, which ran from 1995 to 2005. One of the things I learned from this research was the degree to which both YENA and Amigas Latinas engaged with other organizations in the Chicagoland region. The current project uses an analytical framework of intersectionality to explore how Latina, Black, and South Asian activists understood and understand and confront the different identities and oppressions in their lives and across communities of color, and the type of coalition building politics and ventures that were established in Chicago in the late 80s to the 2000s, especially at a time when working across identities and building solidarity is crucially necessary. The lessons we learn from the coalitional successes and failures of the recent past might inform the research and practices of scholars and activists interested in understanding and advancing coalitional movements for social change. Chicago has experienced a history of coalition among gays and lesbians since the 80s. The group Black and White Men Together, later Men of All Colors Together, formed in the 1980s as a social group where men of different races and cultures gathered to meet each other. This became a model for the women, a group of women who started meeting in the 1990s, and that group was called Women of All Colors and Cultures Together, or WACT, as we like to call it. So WACT was centered around monthly potluck dinners that went on until the 2000s and led to the development of a host of affinity groups, such as Amigas Latinas and Culi Saban, which were established in the 90s. The WACT potlucks led to friendships and relationships that facilitated collaboration of lesbian groups around one project was the International Women's Dances in the late 1980s through the 2000s. That's some of the groups in the 90s. And this is the flyer announcing the International Women's Dances. These events started small and grew to massive events that brought together thousands of women in downtown Chicago hotels. The dances were a way to commemorate International Women's Day and raise money for all the organizations involved. The recurring fundraising effort also led to the building of working relationships, networking, and friendships among women of different races and cultural backgrounds who organized the dances. Only organizations whose membership included at least 75% of women of color were invited to co-sponsor the dances. Among the co-sponsoring organizations were progressive groups of working class women, such as Chicago Women in the Trades, the Literary Foundation, the Mozambican Women's Support Project, Women United for a Better Chicago, as well as affinity groups like Yena and Amigas Latinas. The relationship forged as part of the planning process led to other coalitional efforts. For example, in 1989, Latina women and white women supported the black women protesting against Mountain Moving Coffee House, a feminist performing space where that had booked a show featuring a white Olivia record singer named Diane Davidson, who had been criticized for performing racist songs. While women repeatedly brought it to her attention in a number of settings, Davidson refused to acknowledge that her songs were problematic. The multiracial boycott was successful, and eventually the women's collective of the Coffee House issued an apology to all women of color and agreed that the concert should have been canceled. The relationships formed in these through these efforts presaged the success of the coalitional anti-racism project, the Color Triangle. The Color Triangle ran from 1997 to the early 2000s and was created under the auspices of Lesbi Gay Radio. Lesbi Gay Radio was a broadcast for lesbians and gay listeners offering information on arts, literature, health, and social science news. One of the hosts of the show, Mary Morton, an African-American lesbian, community activist, and a member of the city's Commission on Human Rights, wrote a successful grant to fund the program. The Color Triangle, A Different Look at Racism in Our Community, was what? Oops, that's a different one I can't talk about. This is flyers from Amigas Latinas announcing the different activities of the Color Triangle. Mary Morton describes that a number of issues motivated the formation of this coalition against racism. One was a threat of a boycott by people of color against the annual AIDS Walk in the mid-90s. The AIDS Walk was an event sponsored by the AIDS Foundation of Chicago to raise money to fight AIDS and to help people living with HIV or AIDS. Among other activities, the AIDS Foundation funded local agencies fighting against AIDS. People of color were threatening to boycott the walk because of concern that the foundation funds were not being equitably distributed to agencies run by people of color. In addition, there were a number of racist incidents at the bars in the local gay district known as Boys Town. Many LGBTQ establishments and events at the time almost exclusively catered to only white men. The founders of the Color Triangle announced that they wanted to put racism on the table for the LGBTQ community. They called for a coalition format with the participation of diverse LGBTQ groups to bring together people who normally worked in isolated groups. They invited people from all the Chicago organizations as well as business leaders to come together to discuss the problem of racism and discover strategies to confront racism in the Chicago community. They sought to arrive at unity principles that could inspire all groups to work together. The founders felt that the discussions about race had become academic and theoretical, so they were trying to come up with ways to combat racism in people's everyday lives. For many people, this was the first time race became a focal point of the LGBTQ organizations. The project specifically worked to define racism and to come up with ways to address it within the community. The initial organizing group put together a steering committee with both activist and LGBT business community leaders. Over 100 people participated in the kickoff event in 1997. At that event, they formed three working groups, and each of them had their own focus. One was a dinner group, and that group merely tried to bring people together of different races and cultures in an informal setting over dinner to talk about issues dealing with race that had come up in Chicago. There was another committee, which was the leadership committee, that was tasked to engaging in building leadership within the boards, the LGBTQ boards and organizations in Chicago. They were looking to build people of color leadership, since quite often white groups that were interested in having people of color on their organizations would say, oh, we need people who have leadership experience. That's why we haven't invited anyone. So this was a way of providing that kind of leadership experience to people of color. And then the third group was a white allies group, and what they did was come up with a curriculum for white people to help white people understand racism and engage in the project of dismantling white supremacy. Each group coordinated and planned a number of activities. For example, there were a number of forums organized around race, and this included lectures as well as dances and cultural events. Another thing they did was come up with a list of 100 ways that businesses could be more friendly to people of color within their businesses, and they organized youth scholarships for people of all races. So I talked to some of the people who were involved in collaborating on this effort. And I'll talk about one person very quickly. Nina Hamadi, who is a co-founder of Kuli Zaban, a South Asian group. She talked about one effort where the group came together, created a forum after 9/11 in 2001, where there was, attack on some U.S. cities. And following the attacks, there was a lot of anti-Muslim attacks and bias that was being experienced by the people in the community. So they put together a forum, the Colored Triangle, again bringing together people of different races and cultures to discuss how people were feeling at this time. Kuli Zaban read a statement condemning both the terrorist attacks and the subsequent backlash against Middle Eastern communities. They talked about the importance of considering the broader context, particularly U.S. policies that fuel hatred around the world. And they listed actions that allies of the Middle Eastern communities could take to show support. So in conclusion, the Colored Triangle made the issue of racism in the LGBT community much more visible in Chicago. Through small-scale events and programs, they created awareness and social change. The work reinforced the idea that in order to work toward a lasting change, we need to do more than work within our own identity groups. While such affinity groups have a valuable role, working in isolation can only take us so far. At a certain point, we need to organize with other people to work toward social change. The Colored Triangle ran for 5 years and ended in 2002. The leaders and participants of this effort indicate that an important result of the work was that it gave folks opportunity for internal reflection, and also it forged lasting relationships, networks, and working relationships that have been sustained across the years and are activated again and again as new issues come up. For example, there is a lot of activity from various groups coming together to work on anti-trans violence, on immigration issues, and in support for refugees. So the hope is that the next generation of activists learn from these efforts as the important work of dismantling racism and racist structures continues today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lourdes. A second presentation is actually a co-presentation from Eva Busch and Julia Nitschke. Eva Busch is an anthropologist and art historian interested in participatory power critical theories and practices. Most recently, she coordinated, I actually don't know, you are Eva, or, okay, yeah, I'm looking to. She coordinated the open space and accompanying program at the Kunstsammlung Nordrhein-Westfalen for their Museum Global or Museum Global exhibition. And Julia Nitschke is a freelance performance artist who develops visions for a utopian future of solidarity, most recently at the Sophiensäle here in Berlin. She is interested in political performative think formats for inclusive audiences, which she develops together with Caroline Kapp and Eva. Their most recent work was shown at the Kammerspiele in Munich. And the title of the presentation is Emanzen Express, an intergenerational room of remembrance for feminist history in Bochum.
Okay, thank you very much for this introduction. Thanks for being here and sharing the space. Spread out your towel, take a seat. Welcome to Emanzen Express. This is an invitation to dive into fragmentary stories and histories of feminist struggles of the 1980s and 90s in Bochum. Grab a towel and make yourself comfortable. We are Julia Nitschke and Eva Busch, and we are part of a shared art and community space called Atelier Automatique in Bochum. Bochum, for those of you who are not from Germany, is a post-industrial medium-sized city in West Germany, part of the Ruhr area, and most of all known for its mining history. Our art space, which we run together with 7 to 20 wonderful people, has been shaped by contemporary queer feminist community events, discourses, activities, and aesthetics. In the past 2 months, until this coming Sunday, we have shown here an exhibition that was also a space for intergenerational feminist exchange, and which we would like to introduce to you now. The exhibition had the title Emanzen Express, Gemeinsam sind wir gemeiner. And Gemeinsam sind wir gemeiner means something like together we are meaner. The exhibition dealt with examples of feminist resistance of the 1980s and 90s in Bochum. We were curious about what they did back then, what was important and meaningful, what meant resistance and to what. What did it mean to be a movement? What did feminist activism look like? We wanted to know what was going on right around in our neighborhood. In particular, we dealt with materials from the autonomous women's and lesbians movement. This is also in, I know that this is not internationally the phrase women's and lesbian movement. This is the phrase that was very much, or is used in Germany. That's why it comes again and again. We can talk about this if you like. And this autonomous women's and lesbians movement was very active in Bochum at that time. And so we were looking at their self-published leaflets, newspaper articles, at books and radio broadcasts they produced. For us, they were fragmentary testimonies for the struggles behind achievements that have become invisible and self-evident, and for long-gone self-organized places like an active lesbian center, a women's bookshop, which was 50 meters from our space today, or a squat by women and lesbians right around the corner, which took place in 1983. Just institutionally, this exhibition, Emanzen Express, is part of the project Found Erased Palimpsest of the Akademie der Künste der Welt in Cologne, and the exhibition project Ruhrding Territorien by Urbane Künste Ruhr. State this. To start, the title of the exhibition needs an explanation in English. The German word Emanze comes from emancipation, which is great, but it was used especially in the 80s and 90s in a negative way to describe women who were too feminist, too loud, had too short of hair, were too lesbian and all of that, and who of course hated men. The Emanzen Express, after which we named the exhibition, is a self-published magazine of the autonomous Frauen-Lesben-Referat or Women-Lesbian Department of the Ruhr-Universität in Bochum, the university in Bochum, which appeared regularly between 1986 and 1995, focusing on various feminist themes of the time. The magazine functioned as a resonance space and amplifier of feminist activities in the city and beyond, and thus serves us today as an entry into the not so distant past. One of the starting points for us to go into this research project as part of the Atelier Automatique was a general frustration about what we would call generation bubbles within feminist, queer, and lesbian communities. When we speak about communities here, we have to be aware that Bochum is not Berlin. And from our experience, there's a need for queer and feminist community spaces, and allies and finding subcultural spaces for being together can't be taken for granted. But as in most cases, the spaces that exist are largely segregated by age. Older lesbians don't visit queer spaces and events very much, and vice versa. This goes along with an idea of generational conflicts, where differences between generations are emphasized. For us, it was astonishing that we actually knew of almost no spaces in which feminists, queers, and lesbians of different generations come together. We found the few such spaces that we were allowed to experience in the past partly challenging, but above all, very empowering. So our desire was to somehow bridge a perceived gap in discourse. By taking a look at the archives that exist in Bochum, by exhibiting and discussing materials from a time that we have not experienced ourselves consciously, that's what we wanted to do. There is, of course, not really a gap in time. Yet, if we do not keep talking to each other, spend time together, and invest energy in understanding each other's concepts, needs, and vulnerabilities, much valuable knowledge is lost on the one hand, and on the other hand, we waste a lot of energy on the devaluation of the others because we construct it as our counterpart. So our aims were getting to know each other, sharing spaces, celebrating the power of past generations of feminist, lesbian, and queer activists in their fight against different forms of oppression like sexism, homophobia, or racism, but also of ableism and classism, which, of course, were of great relevance in a post-industrial era that was shaped largely by its working class and also migrant population. Our approach to this history was less one to quickly judge what we found or also what was missing, and also not to discuss huge concepts, which often happens, I have the feeling. Rather, through concrete examples of spaces, actions, and personal encounters, we wanted to make everyone involved curious and somehow at first become open for dialogue. Become curious, be it activists from different ages, visitors, or just passers-by. For our research, we cooperated with the three women's archives in Bochum. This is actually really special that a city like Bochum, which is not so huge, has three independent women's archives. The oldest, which is the students' women's library Liesel, was founded at the university in 1978. Out of the autonomous women's lesbians movement, the archive Auszeiten was founded in 1995, which is until today also a women's space or women's room, and has by far the largest collection, also including a film archive, shelves full of newspaper articles, and what was particularly exciting for us, many flyers and other so-called gray materials, leaflets, flyers, and brochures from the movement in Bochum. Since 2000, there's also the Madonna Archive and Documentation Center Sexarbeit or on sex work, affiliated to a self-organization of sex workers. In the search for places, discourses, and events that shaped the feminist Bochum of the 80s and 90s, we held talks with the archivists on the one hand, which of the materials and histories they would consider particularly relevant. But we also searched extensively within the collections ourselves in order to look from our perspectives. What appeals to us? What inspires us, both in terms of content and aesthetics? What is new to us and perhaps contradicts stereotypical images of this generation? The cooperation with the archives was therefore rather a collaboration, which was possible because they come from political struggles and have an understanding of themselves as a community archive. And it was clear that we somehow can be part of this community. a negotiation about how certain content should be presented and contextualized had to take place together in the sense of getting to know each other and the stories behind the material. The discussion of feminist positions and the building of mutual trust played a central role. This work on relationships and the following building of trust was by no means just a side effect of the project.
Our exhibition concept moves between more informative and performative elements. On the one hand, there is a 5-meter by 3-meter city map of Bochum. This new map of Bochum, with a focus of feminist resistance and struggles in the 80s and 90s, was firstly designed to give a topographically structured overview. What was there? First of all, the visitors are confronted with an incredible amount of places and events from this time. Like, wow, there was a lot of going on. This map could also be read as a kind of, let's say, feminist conspiracy theory. Because the narratives that otherwise surround Bochum's history are mostly concerning history of mining, which is not found there at all, but overlaid with a lot of feminist actions. Here it was important for us to display the leaflets and newspaper articles and magazines and places in their context. We also produced a printed version of this map. It looks like this, and we have a lot of them with us, which visitors are invited to take home, and we brought it for you, as I spoiled it before, so you can take a copy at home as well if you want. It's in German, though. A crucial aspect of the map was that, as obviously no map can ever be complete, there are still empty boxes which can be filled out with additional information. So also visitors are invited to add more material to the map on the wall, which some happily did. A second element is the pool. Within the exhibition space, we built a pool, which is filled with reproduced leaflets. So up to 5 or 6 people, it depends how comfortable you are with closelessness, were able to dive into our pool at the same time. And the pool and its 9-part towel gang are performative and playful. With the pool, it was important to us to deal with the materiality and the medium leaflet. It is a medium that was actually designed to be thrown away after the event is over. And now it finds its place in an exhibition, but it's not treated according to common museum practices. They are not hung in a frame. On the contrary, a physical confrontation was very important to us. All materials can be taken in hand, rest on them, bathe in them. This might seem also a bit disrespectful to some of you at first sight, but at least we get into contact. With us, the reproducted leaflets are also in the pool again, in which everyone can get in and then bathe in the movement, like in the women's energy of that time. This was an actual phrase at that time. When diving into the pool, coincidence plays a big role. Which leaflet with which content gets into your hands or in the hands of our visitors? Here we wanted to establish the narrative of holidays, like spread out your towel, take a seat, welcome to Emanzen Express. This is an invitation to dive into fragmentary stories of feminist struggles of the 80s and 90s in Bochum. For our project, we worked together with the artists Die Blaue Distanz, Anna Erdmann and Franziska Guralski. They worked with other archival material before, especially from a lesbian archive in LA. They used their magic for the design and the font Women in Motion, which was developed especially for the Emanzen Express. The font is based on handwritten letters, which they found in the material of Bochum, and which they turned into a digital font. So here you can have a look at it. This font is now used in various ways in the exhibition, including on towels, which are there, which are present in the room as a gang, and also on the map. In general, we are looking for the aesthetics strategies which would offer proximity to the materials we had found in the archives, but were also far from being nostalgic, rather looking for contemporary forms. There was another collaboration with the artists Laura Nitsch and Katja Lell, who have worked on the topic of witches using paper as their material. As we know that in 1988, there has been a clash between the police and 400 protesting women as witches as part of their Walpurgisnacht demonstration, we asked them to reflect on this event and its memory. The result was a reflection on our desire for documents and evidence for events that have taken place. There were a lot of moments of coming together, and for our project it was central to get together again and again, to exchange ideas, to establish a connection. We invited to a performative city tour, various discussions, film screenings, and a feminist summer school. This feminist summer school took place under the motto, we still have to reinvent ourselves, but we don't have to start all over again. And we would like to open up a space in joint workshops in order to make the access to archives of feminist movement histories come alive with you and transfer into it into today. What do we do with these testimonies? How can we reinvent ourselves today as feminists in the face of the past forms? So here again, the main aim was to see how we can strengthen our relationship to the material and the movement and how it can empower us today and also where we need to disagree. The opening of the Amanzen Express was performed by Die Blaue Distanz with a wonderful opening ceremony, which already brought together a lot of experienced women and lesbians, also known as Emanzen, and some younger Emanzen. And of course, diving into history is not always pleasant. It is important for us to mention that the history we have dealt with, like any other history, is full of injuries and violence, and the materials we have taken out of the archives may reactivate partly personal injuries as well as structural violence. This is only partially foreseeable, was on our minds, and still sometimes we failed as well to be careful enough. The late 80s and early 90s were not only in Germany a time of new forms of racism. As we were aware that some of the materials were also about anti-racism and contained these memories, we invited to France to host an exhibition discussion in a safer space for BPOC, but there were also regular gatherings open to everyone, like an Emanzen Express reading circle.
I think the time is more than over, right?
Yes, over.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry for mixing up the names again.
We have actually two projects now. We're going to hear about two projects from the FF BITS, which is the first FS for women or feminist? For feminists. So the FF BITS is the feminists' research, education, and information center. Is that right in English? Yeah, okay. Our next presenter is Friederike Mehl, who has been working for Social Movement Archives in Berlin since 2013, and most recently at the FF BITS as well as the Spinnboden Lesbian Archive and Library. She has conducted the oral history project Berlin in Bewegung, AktivistInnen erzählen von der Frauen-Lesben-Bewegung nach 1968, which translates as Moving Berlin, Activists Recount the Lesbian Women's Movement in Berlin. And the project website, berlin-in-bewegung.de, has, Friederike has written to me in brackets, hopefully, and it has actually been launched a few days ago. And the title of her presentation is The Potentials and Pitfalls of Digitization for Feminist Oral History. Thank you so much, Friederike. And Lena Kühn is our next presenter. She studied historical and cultural anthropology in Tübingen and has done lots of research on second wave feminism in feminist archives. And she's been working for the FFBIT since 2016, mainly on digitization projects. She is coordinating the FFBIT's most recent digitization project, Peaceful Revolution? Lesbian Feminist Perspectives on 1989, and she will talk about that right now.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to talk about our project here. It's also a project that has a huge part of it is oral history or oral her story. And we are still in the middle of the project, so all of this critical reviewing Friederike just did will take place after the project also for this. I think that's very necessary. Yes, but I'm giving you a quick introduction to our current project and also a bit of a preview or teaser of what you can expect to be released online in hopefully less than a month. So, yeah. Our project, Peaceful Revolution, Lesbian Feminist Perspectives on 1989, is a cooperation project between the Spinnboden Lesbian Archive and Library and the FFBITS. And we try to take the 30th anniversary of the opening of the Berlin Wall this year as an opportunity to view this time of transformation, Umbruch, from perspectives that have received little attention so far in the public remembrance culture and in the German media and in publications. We have, want to ask following questions. How did lesbian feminist activists in East and West Berlin perceive the opening of the Berlin Wall and its consequences? Which new connections did they form around the time 1989 and in the years that followed? How did these connections intensify or change? Which encounters took place, and how have migrant, Jewish, and Muslim women and women of color within the lesbian and women's movement experienced this time? Our project is funded by the Digitales Deutsches Frauenarchiv, the online platform. It's a digitization project, so we had the opportunity to digitize rare books and newspaper articles and documentations. The materials you can see in these pictures are some of the materials we digitized. Examples are books about the situation of women and lesbians in the GDR, feminist brochures on feminist women and groups in the GDR, documentations of the Lesbenwoche, Lesbian Week conferences in the 90s. We will put some of these materials online soon, not all of them, because we haven't clarified all the copyright issues yet, but they are digitized now, and you can take a look at the digital documents in the FFBITS and in the Spinnboden. What is the digital documents we can put online? You can search them and find them in META, our joint catalog for the German language lesbian and women's archives. So aside from the documents we digitized, we also did this huge part of the project interviews, more video interviews with feminist activists who've been active around 1989 in West Berlin and East Berlin. These are the six people we interviewed. The first is Katharina Oguntoye, who was born in the GDR in Zwickau and then grew up in Nigeria and West Germany and lived in West Berlin at the time of the opening of the wall. She was very active in the women's movement and lesbian movement and co-founded ADEFRA, a group for black women in Germany and an initiative for black people in Germany.
The second one is Bettina Jiggle. She founded the Arbeitskreis Homosexuelle Selbsthilfe, so a self-help group for homosexuals in the GDR that later became Lesben in der Kirche, Lesbians in the Church. Sevim Çelebi Goçlik was one of the first women, she was the first migrant woman in the Berlin Parliament and also very active in the in many groups that concerned migrant women. Christina Karstedt worked for GDR Television and was active in the GDR Lesbian Women Movement and released a movie in 92 with interviews with feminist activists in the GDR and lesbians in the GDR. Samira Kenavi was also very active in the GDR Women and Lesbian Movement and built up the archive Grauzone concerning the feminist movement in the GDR. And Benjamin Bader was also in West Berlin very active in the lesbian movement and now teaches Jewish history. All of them gave us interviews. Ben Bader's picture looks a little bit different because we could only do a Skype interview with him, so we won't put the clips of him online because it's really low quality, but you can take a look at the transcript or the audio file of this interview in the archive. I'm going to only show you a little preview clip today of the interview with Bettina Jiggle. So you have an impression of what our interviews look like.
Ich habe 1982 mit Freundinnen aus lauter Frust heraus, weil es, so fanden wir damals, kein lesbisches, öffentliches lesbisches Leben gab in der ehemaligen DDR, wir hatten einen sehr formellen Namen, Arbeitskreis Homosexuelle Selbsthilfe Lesben in der Kirche gegründet. Und wir haben dann bis genau 89, bis genau zur Wende, war ich tätig in dieser Gruppe. Wir waren Anfang der 80er Jahre auch in der Philippuskapelle. Wir hatten da einen Platz und haben uns da getroffen und konnten dann, und das war das Gute, 84, 85 waren wir in der Gethsemane-Kirche im Prenzlauer Berg tätig. Der Kontext war einfach nicht gesehen werden, uns gab es nicht. Weder in der Literatur, noch in Zeitschriften, noch auf der Straße. Es gab einfach keine Anlaufmöglichkeiten und ich hatte große Probleme mit meinem Coming-out. Ich wusste nicht, was lesbisch bedeutet, obwohl ich mit einer Frau schon kurz lebte, sie liebte. Habe erst später erfahren, dass das so eine Definition habe, sage ich jetzt mal so blöd. Und das hat mich total frustriert.
I'm gonna stop here and quickly summarize in English when I put the PowerPoint back up. Bettina Jiggle talks about lesbian life in the GDR and mostly the frustration with the invisibility of lesbians in the GDR, and that this frustration led her and her friends to found this self-help group for homosexuals within the church. And she talks about how she didn't even know she didn't even know the word lesbian, even though she was already in a relationship with a woman. This is just one example of we have more or less timelines within our interview. We always ask questions about before the opening of the wall, how this time was experienced during the opening and during the times of transformation in 89, and then what happened afterwards and how that was experienced. And this was an example of the before on the east side of the wall, so we have quite some content on lesbian life in the GDR in our interviews, but also about the relationship between feminists in the east and feminists in the west of the city, or the non-existing relationship. For example, Bettina Jiggle said that the West didn't care about us, but some of the contexts that actually existed are talked about in the videos, like some information leaking from the West to the East in the form of women smuggling books to the East. It's made quite clear in the interviews that the spring and summer of 89 is like the climax for women lesbian movement in the GDR. Lots of new groups are formed, and the already existing groups are very active. Just some examples for how the time during the opening of the wall is described are that people in the east of the city were very excited for a short while and thought that everything was possible and they could actively be able to take part and participate and help shape the future of their country. And in other parts of the interviews, there's a lot of fear and uncertainty that is described due to the political situation and the instability, and also feelings of depression and resignation that occur shortly after the opening of the wall. The opening of the wall is also described with feelings of threat connected to the masses of people in the street, which is very much different to how it's often portrayed in the media. It's often focused on the euphoria of the moment. Something that almost all of our interviewees described in the part after the opening of the wall and the following years is the rise in nationalism and racism that occurred after 1989. They talk about the words that are shouted, we are the people, wir sind das Volk, more or less turning into we are one people, so the German-German relationship, and that leads to the exclusion of people of color and migrants after the opening of the wall. Like our interview partner, Sevim Chilibi-Gottschlich, I have a quote here. She said, this multicultural society that we've been fighting for years all of a sudden got lost after the fall of the wall. The German-German relationship became much more important. This is something that turned up a lot in our interviews. I'll come to the end. Yeah, our interviews will be put online in July, hopefully. You can view them on the Meta catalog that I've showed you before, and probably on our Vimeo account. You should follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get notified when we put them online. Also, join our newsletter. And if you want to know more, ask questions or contact us. Contact me with the email kuhn@ffbits.de. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena, and thank you all for your presentations. Would you all come up now? And we've got 15 minutes, 20 minutes left for questions and discussions. There's a microphone over there. You can use it, and if you do not feel comfortable with going over there, I or my colleague will hand the microphone to you. So, questions. Yes, Maria. You go.
Hello, my name is Maria Bühner. That was a mind-blowing panel. I want to thank all of you for these presentations. I have a question, and I have to say, like, as a researcher, I'm so happy to know that these documents are going online, and I think we need much more interviews and much more materials online because that really helps. I'm still a little bit stuck with this 1989-1990 fall of the Berlin Wall, and I'm wondering what were they hoping for? I mean, there were just like some thoughts on it. Maybe there's a little bit more on this. What kind of opportunities will open up by this system change? Yeah, I would love to hear more about this.
Okay. So yeah, there's really a lot in the interviews, and I can talk about all of it here. But yeah, especially for the women who experienced this in East Berlin, they formed groups like Lila Offensive und Unabhängiger Frauenverband that were supposed to take part in the political process that followed the opening of the wall. And our interviewees also talk about how they had hopes of reforming the GDR and were more or less overrun by the political events that followed, which also, yeah, for some led to a lot of frustration and resignation. But it's also, I think, in our interviews kind of diverse how people or how women in the East experienced this. I don't know. You also know all the content. Do you want to add something?
Maybe the wrong way. I think it's just one thing I think would be interesting to add is that actually already before the opening of the wall, women's groups had these ideas that there would be a change and that they could be more active and that they should also gather and make plans of what would happen. So I think already from like the summer of 1989, one of my interviewees said something like, you could feel the system weakening, and they lost control over like all these different forms of, not necessarily even opposition, but just all these forms of like individual expression and activism. So there was just more room to take part and create things, and to talk about issues that before were maybe more regulated by the authorities.
So, hi, thanks a lot for these fascinating cases that you were presenting here. I was just two questions, one on access and one on sustainability, and they're for all of you, but some might feel more inclined to answer these. When it comes to sustainability, I mean, you're doing such an amazing work. How do you guarantee that your amazing projects will still be around when the funding runs out? Who will take care of the websites? Do you have a plan B in case you don't get funding? Do you work with other archives which are more sustainable? I'm thinking of the Freiwe Archiv in Bergen, which also does a lot of oral history interviews, but they are connected to the university library. So there is this kind of long-standing thought, even if the project money runs out. When it comes to access, the last clip we've seen was obviously without any subtitles and without any audio descriptions. Have you thought about these things? And is it just a matter of lack of resources that they are not there?
Yes, it's the lack of resources. We've thought about this. We had so many ideas to make it, and then we really had to cut off a lot of things that, like, from a political point of view, I think was very wrong to cut them. So there's like this ethical conundrum of always doing the stuff that you actually know you shouldn't do or you should be doing, like, right from the start. When it comes to sustainability, I think already the continued existence of our archive is a bit of a miracle of sustainability, because it has existed from 1978 against all odds. It does receive some funding from the city. This is what the FFBITS is run by, and then also like third-party funding from like different funding bodies.
And I think this is how we will continue to be sustainable, because it's also an idea of having this like history from below. So I'm not sure whether, and I'm saying this while the head of the FFP is sitting right there, whether like these collaborations with much larger archives or, for example, university infrastructures would really be an idea of guaranteeing this sustainability. It's also a political question. I'm sure I haven't answered everything, but maybe you want to add things?
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, I have two questions that like I think address the whole panel. I was wondering on the one hand whether because of the last two presentations especially, I was wondering what role the specific political system that people were living in were having on people's lives and how that like is informing your work, like the capital, like, you know, lesbians under capitalism, lesbians under socialism. That's one question. And the other question is, because I strongly believe that cisgendered women are women too, I was wondering what the specific role of cisgendered women in your work is.
Thanks for this question, and I think I can mostly answer to the second one. Thank you very much for this question. I mean, in our project, we did this as two cisgendered women, and we were aware of that this is a specific perspective. We were looking at archives that were run by cisgendered women that have collected mostly stories of cisgendered women, and actually, there's one case that is not just about cisgendered women. As far as we know, there's always this question of visibility of narration, and I think this is something that we were definitely aware of while researching it. But yeah, of course, there's a lot of produced invisibility by cisgendered women. Maybe just to not leave your first question unaddressed, I feel I'm taking a lot of space here. It's a really big question, like the idea of how women, I think this is what the question was, lived in different systems and how these experiences compare. And I think this has also been a challenge because we put things or context together that don't really go together very well. And I think what is interesting about this is that also women who then met each other, like also personally after the wall opened, like they realized this, that the communication, even though there was a lot of like interest in each other, that communication didn't work well at all. And it has actually, I think it still informs the communication today and a lot of politics today in different forms, but it's an open question. Sorry for not addressing the other question, but I can talk to you afterwards if.
I'm really fascinated to see so many other young people also doing research or doing projects, looking into lesbian women's history of the 70s and so on. I wanted to ask you, like, what's your experience with this? How do you, are there also challenges in this? Maybe you can share some personal reflection on this. I mean, there are also these conflicts. You mentioned it before. I really like this phrase. You put it we're not nostalgic, or we don't throw back a nostalgic view on history, but we kind of find contemporary forms. And I would like to ask all of you for maybe if you can share or also say what you can bring into this, maybe as new perspectives.
Okay, I will start. We, as I said, we started this project. It was a question mostly also of self-empowerment, I would say, and by getting in contact with each other. So definitely this project, this research is about somehow finding strength from getting together, but also by, learning about for example, about our neighborhood. We didn't know this, but our art space is really surrounded by important historical places that nobody is speaking about anymore. And this is really something that I find super empowering, to know about this history that's really surrounding us. And so this is just one aspect, which also many people shared this experience, or many visitors, especially young visitors who spend hours looking at all the material, and this is not exaggerating. And another thing is that I have made the experience that it helps to not get stuck with words too soon. But and not to like to of course sometimes words can be really harmful, and then we have to make an intervention. But sometimes it's also good to be a bit more relaxed with words and phrases that we use, and maybe take time to discuss what do you actually mean when you use this word. What do you actually mean when you use this word? So bridging a gap in discourse, I would say, is that has a lot to do with being ready to get surprised, I would say. Yeah.
As an older lesbian, I can say that looking at these coalitions that I've been looking at, what inspired me was being, since I teach at a university, is working with younger people who are trying to form coalitions, and seeing them make all these mistakes that if they even knew a little bit about very recent history, perhaps there would be other ways of thinking about things. So my project is motivated by that desire to make that kind of intervention known to people, so that perhaps there could be more intergenerational conversations, so we don't have to reinvent or make the same mistakes time and time again.
Yes, hello. I also wanted to ask about the challenges and for the last speaker. I come from Denmark, and we have issues related to intersectional identities with people with Muslim background who are now struggling with how to combine their religious and ethnic background. Could you say something about that in an American context?
I could say that in the period I was looking at, there were a lot of efforts made to work with different groups, but not really looked at intersections within individuals. But now we see more of that happening, and understanding that all of us have many identities, and that it is really difficult to compartmentalize things the way we like to do, but trying to look at things with a more intersectional perspective has been helpful in a way that I don't think some of our movements have engaged in the past.
Yeah, thank you all very much for your presentations. I'm here for the Berlin Wall Foundation, so I'm very interested in the last two presentations. And I have a question for Friederike. So you talked about the challenges with data protection and with finding interview partners. And I would like to know, was it clear from the beginning was it possible for people to get interviewed and without being presented online? Or is there an archive behind the online archive? Or is everything online?
Yes, there's an archive behind the archive. There's 23 interviews. Well, online there's currently only 5. And we made it very clear to our interview partners that the material didn't have to go online. It would have been difficult in the last project because we knew we would put up 5, and if it's 4, just even less. But yeah, I think it was also important for us to give people this choice and to be like, yeah, to be able to be on, like, be filmed and be present, but in a different context.
One more question. There's room for one more question.
Sorry, I wasn't here for the whole presentation, but I had an oral history question too, about kind of similar, about your agreement with the oral history subjects. Do they get to choose if it gets to be online? Is that what you were saying? And also, what does that document they sign say? Can they put in restrictions of other kinds? And once they sign it and they want to go back on something, what happens then? I was just curious.
Just with any contract, like, this is not, like, it doesn't last for life. So if they wanted to change anything, they have the legal right to do so, and I think also the ethical right to do so. So even though it would be, like, sad for us because we invest quite a lot of money and time in preparing the materials, of course people can change their contracts, and yes, they are actual contracts. They're 4 pages long, very difficult prose, and put some people off, like, a lot.
Okay, thank you very much. Our time is up now, I'm afraid. Before I thank you all, I have to make 2 announcements. There is a dinner break now, and it happens, I guess, on the terrace, I suppose, where you've already been. And there is the theater play of the Livingston's Cabinet from Copenhagen, The Einstein of Sex, about Magnus Hirschfeld in the hall where we had the first gathering in the morning. Now, thank you very much for your amazing presentations, for being here. Give them a warm round of applause, please. You can take the materials from Eva and Julia talked about. They're lying around here. And thank you all for attending this session. Good evening.